This is September 28th, 2014. And today I'm going to talk about enlightenment East and West, seeing the differences and the similarities between enlightenment as we refer to it in Buddhism and Asian philosophy and religion, as compared to the Enlightenment period of history in the 17th and 18th centuries, and the values and that were part of that so-called Enlightenment. And how they East and West meet in the person of Barbara Ehrenreich, an activist, atheist, and best-selling author. Barbara Ehrenreich, I've been following her for decades, admiring her magnificent writing. She's reading here from Wikipedia. She's an American writer and political activist who describes herself as a myth-buster by trade and has been called a veteran muckraker by The New Yorker. During the 1980s and early 90s, she was a prominent figure in the Democratic Socialists of America. She's a widely read and award-winning columnist and essayist and author of 21 books. It says that she's perhaps best known for her 2001 book, Nickel and Dimed, on not getting by in America. The book is a memoir of her three-month experiment surviving on minimum wage as a waitress, hotel maid, house cleaner, nursing home aide, and Walmart clerk. It was described by Newsweek magazine as jarring and full of riveting grit. And The New Yorker called it an exposé putting human flesh on the bones of such abstractions as living wage and affordable housing. So Ehrenreich, you could say, is a paragon, a proponent of this Enlightenment era of the 17th and 18th centuries at its best. I looked up this Enlightenment, this kind of the Enlightenment period, to be sure I'm clear about it, and it defined it as an intellectual movement of the 17th and 18th centuries marked by a celebration of the powers of human reason, a keen interest in science, the promotion of religious toleration, and a desire to construct governments free of tyranny. The major figures of this Enlightenment era were David Hume, Immanuel Kant, John Locke, Rousseau, and Voltaire, among others. It's science, it's interesting, science is one of these. Let's say, let's repeat them. Human reason, science, religious toleration, and justice, we could say, is another one. And Ehrenreich seems to have devoted her life to advancing the causes of these areas. Beginning with science, she was a scientist. She studied chemistry. Get a load of her senior thesis, Electrochemical Oscillations of the Silicon Anode. She got a PhD in cellular immunology from Rockefeller University. And then she said she gave birth to her daughter Rosa, named after Rosa Parks, in a public clinic in New York. And these are her words. I was the only white patient at the clinic. They induced my labor because it was late in the evening and the doctor wanted to go home. I was enraged. The experience made me a feminist. And then from there, she went on to become an activist in all these ways that we've mentioned. Other books by her are The American Health Empire, Power, Profits, and Politics, 1971. That must have been one of the first critics of that, all that. Witches, Midwives, and Nurses, A History of Women Healers. Complaints and Disorders, The Sexual Politics of Sickness. For Her Own Good, 2 Centuries of the Experts' Advice to Women. Women in the Global Factory. The Hearts of Men, American Dreams and the Flight from Commitment. Fear of Falling, The Inner Life of the Middle Class. The Worst Years of Our Lives, Irreverent Notes from a Decade of Greed. And then Nickel and Dimed. And so it really caught my eye when I ran across not just one, but two columns by her, or one column and one interview in print, and then also an NPR interview of her reporting on a so-called mystical experience she had when she was very young. She made a book out of this called Living with a Wild God. And so I'm going to read this. This is from the New York Times this spring, April 6th, and it's under on the opinion page. And these are her words. My atheism is hardcore, rooted in family tradition rather than adolescent rebellion. According to family legend, one of my 19th century ancestors, a dirt-poor Irish-American woman in Montana, expressed her disgust with the church by vehemently refusing last rites when she lay dying in childbirth. From then on, we were atheists and rationalists, a stance I perpetuated by opting initially for a career in science. How else to understand the world except as the interaction of tiny bits of matter and mathematically predictable forces? There were no gods or spirits, just our own minds, our own minds pressing up against the unknown. That's a nice phrase, our own minds pressing up against the unknown. That really, in a way, goes to the very essence of spiritual practice. Most religions will not be able to endure the unknown and will have to go to the notion of a God, a creator God, someone in control of all this. In Zen, we know that this is the unknown, is the well of our own boundless wisdom. And now her experience. But something happened when I was 17 that shook my safely rationalist worldview and left me with a lifelong puzzle. Years later, I learned that this sort of event is usually called a mystical experience, and I can see in retrospect that these circumstances had been propitious. Thanks to a severely underfunded and poorly planned skiing trip, I was sleep deprived. Remember that when you're next in Sashin. I was sleep deprived and probably hypoglycemic that morning in 1959 when I stepped out alone, walked into the streets of Lone Pine, California, and saw the world, the mountains, the sky, the low scattered buildings, suddenly flame into life. There were no visions, no prophetic voices or visits by totemic animals. Just this blazing everywhere, something poured into me and I poured out into it. This was not the passive beatific merger with the all, she has in quotation marks, as promised by the Eastern mystics. It was a furious encounter with a living substance that was coming at me through all things at once. Too vast and violent to hold on to, too heartbreakingly beautiful to let go of. It seemed to me that whether you start as a twig or a gorgeous tapestry, you will be recruited into the flame and made indistinguishable from the rest of the blaze. I felt ecstatic and somehow completed, but also shattered. Let me just venture to to try to suggest an understanding of the terms that she uses here, beginning with flame, the world flame. Suddenly, the world flamed into life. It's a very vivid image, of course, but and one that seems to come about as close as anything to capturing the world of change, the world of flux, of dynamism, of process. It's kind of change made visible, a flame or flames. And this is this element of flux is understood in the Dharma as one of the three basic characteristics of existence, that there is no thingness, no fixed substance to us or anything. Everything is this world of flux, which she calls flame. Certainly she wasn't talking about heat, so if she's not talking about heat, then what she means is this force of destruction creation, this utterly, wildly vital world of dynamism that is going on all the time. This is what in Zen is called momentary birth and death. There's the conventional notion of death as just something that happens after 80 or 90 years or whatever. But the other death that's going on all the time is millisecond by millisecond in terms of our cells, molecules and atoms. Everything is in a state of flux. This is one of the three characteristics of existence. The other is the pervasiveness of suffering in this phenomenal world. And the third is no self. No self is another, really, just a logical outgrowth of the teaching of impermanence, of insubstantiality or emptiness, we sometimes say. If everything is in flux, then so are we. There is no permanent entity anywhere, including no God or soul. Furious. It was a furious encounter, she says, with a living substance. Oh, or no substance. It was coming at me through all things at once, too vast and violent to hold on to, too heartbreakingly beautiful to let go of. Can't hold on to it. Can't hold on to this kind of experience because it is living. It's an experience. It's flux. And who, anyway, would be holding on to what? I'm giving my own Buddhist interpretation of this experience. She may not accept this, but in our terms, this is how I see it. You will be recruited into the flame and made indistinguishable from the rest of the blaze. So this is an experience of non-differentiation. And this is another word for emptiness or no self, indistinguishable from the rest of the blaze. I felt ecstatic and somehow completed, but also shattered. Shattered. It's hard to know from that description whether it was a very disturbing in a way, or shattered could be very positive, losing yourself, seeing that there is no self that we're stuck with. She continues, "Of course I said nothing about this to anyone, since I recognize no deities, and even the notion of an, quote, altered state of consciousness was unavailable at the time. I was left with only one explanation. I had had a mental breakdown. Ultimately explainable as a matter of chemical imbalances," there's the scientist, "overloaded circuits, or identifiable psychological forces. There had been some sort of brief equipment failure. That was all. And I determined to pull myself together and put it behind me, going on to finish my formal education as a cellular immunologist and become a responsible, productive citizen." "It took an inexcusably long time for me to figure out that what had happened to me was part of a widespread category of human experience. Some surveys find that nearly half of Americans report having had a mystical experience. Historically, the range of people reporting such experiences is wide, including saints, shamans, and Old Testament prophets, as well as acknowledged non-believers like Virginia Woolf and the contemporary atheist writer Sam Harris. It is, of course, impossible to ascertain how much these experiences have in common. We may be comparing apples and asteroids." "On the religious end of the spectrum, people have tended to describe their experiences as encounters with familiar deities or spirits, while non-believers, like some quoted by William James, are likely to speak of a more generic living presence," capital P, a living presence. That's not bad. Or, in Zen, we would say a living absence. Others write of something more akin to my own experience, which was wordless," that's very significant, "wordless and profoundly unsettling." Unsettling, if you've lived your whole life with a certain mental grid based on this and that, us and them, self and other, time, the past, present, and future, success and failure, right and wrong, good and bad, all of these dualisms are what we grow up with. This is the deep conditioning that we have as growing up in this culture. And suddenly she had a glimpse into what is beyond all that, all such ideas, concepts. "Wordless," she said. Suddenly she was no longer embedded in abstractions, but she got a peek at what is beyond abstractions, words, concepts. When the early 20th century Protestant theologian Rudolf Otto surveyed the works of mostly Christian mystics for clues as to the nature of the other they had encountered, he concluded that it was, quote, "beyond all question, something quite other than the good. It was more like a consuming fire," he wrote, "and must be gravely disturbing to those persons who will recognize nothing in the divine nature but goodness, gentleness, love, and a sort of confidential intimacy." To to some people bring that also as part of their baggage to Zen, the notion of some ultimate goodness or even love. But the problem with that is that it's so long as we give it any kind of designation, even it, the word it is a designation. So long as we use any word for this that is beyond all words, then we miss it. In the Mumon Kan, there's a verse in which Mumon says, "You describe it in vain, you picture it to no avail." He's referring to this true nature, this Buddha nature, this essential original mind of ours. And all those are also, all those designations miss it. Some have argued, reasonably enough, that we say we have no God concept in Buddhism. Well, but what about these terms, true nature, Buddha nature, original self? Aren't those basically what people with a more sophisticated understanding of God mean when they say God? It doesn't have to be an old man up in the sky with a beard and whatever it is. And they're right. It's if you think of if for people with a more sophisticated understanding of God as the ineffable, the ultimate principle, that which is the transcendent, then yeah, you could say that that true nature is kind of a kind of God, a reference to God, but not as an agent, not as a creator. And in any case, Zen always comes back and says, don't even use those words. It's not like God is wrong and true nature is okay. Even true nature and these other synonyms for this ultimate reality, these two miss it. But to point to it, almost inevitably we have to use words. And so we've settled on these conventional Zen words. But to have a descriptive term like goodness or love, this is limits it. I'm going to read just a short passage from the account of another woman's spontaneous enlightenment. I don't know if we could call Aaron Reich's experience any kind of awakening. Maybe it gave her the insight into the unity of all beings that informed her career in social and political activism. It's impossible to know from a short description whether it could be considered in Zen terms an awakening. It doesn't matter. It obviously had a profound effect on her. But there's another, this other woman, her name is Flora Courtois. She wrote a very small book about the size of your hand, called An Experience of Enlightenment. And some of you have heard this about this woman and her experience. Very briefly, she was a college student in Ann Arbor, the University of Michigan, and she found herself gripped by the question, what is reality? Or what is real, I guess. Same thing. And she was so completely lost in that question that she was kind of out of her mind for a while. And that's the first half of the book, is all of her groping her way, stumbling through the campus, just completely consumed by this question, what is real? It's kind of a natural koan then. Until it all burst open, and she had what what later what seems to have been a genuine enlightenment experience, spontaneous, without any familiarity with even the word enlightenment, other than the 17th century version of the word enlightenment. But she had never heard of Kensho, of awakening, of Zen or Buddhism or anything else. She had no reference, no context for what happened to her. But I'm just going to read this because it's so wonderful, as just another description of someone else who had a spontaneous opening. She was sitting in her room after months, I think 4 months, of questioning. The small, pale green desk at which I'd been so thoughtlessly gazing had totally and radically changed. It appeared now with a clarity, a depth of three-dimensionality, a freshness I had never imagined possible. At the same time, in a way that is utterly indescribable, all my questions and doubts were gone as effortlessly as chaff in the wind. I knew everything and all at once, yet not in the sense that I had ever known anything before. All things were the same in my little bedroom, yet totally changed. Still sitting in wonder on the edge of my narrow bed, one of the first things I realized was that the focus of my sight seemed to have changed. It had sharpened to an infinitely small point which moved ceaselessly in paths totally free of the old accustomed ones, as if flowing from a new source. What on earth had happened? So released from all tension, so ecstatically light did I feel, I seemed to float down the hall to the bathroom to look at my face in the mottled mirror over the sink. The pupils of my eyes were dark, dilated, and brimming with mirth. With a wondrous relief, I began to laugh as I'd never laughed before, from the soles of my feet upward. The foundations had fallen from my world. There is that. What Ehrenreich refers to as shattered. I had plunged into a numinous openness which had obliterated all fixed distinctions, including that of within and without. A presence, there's that word again, a presence had absorbed the universe, including myself, and to this I surrendered in absolute confidence. That's all I'll read. Note the difference here, where she just surrenders to it, to this presence, to this ineffable. She surrenders to it, and as a result of that, by letting go and completely opening to it, she finds herself overjoyed. As compared to what I read from Ehrenreich's account as something not quite there. Maybe we can suppose that what happened to her was not a real breakthrough of going all the way, but a glimpse into the emptiness of this phenomenal world. And that's not awakening. Just seeing the emptiness aspect of the phenomenal world is not the real thing, and it's quite common that just getting that far, just getting to the threshold of awakening by seeing the emptiness side of things, is frightening. Many people who've gotten that far, and many people don't get that far, but many people have gotten that far report the fear that can grip them, and the fear is just not taking one more step. The kind of tensing and wanting, not surrendering, but trying to maintain some kind of understanding or control over the process. Maybe that's why this was, she described as too vast and violent to hold on to, and shattered, the word shattered. Flora Courtois, since she had no idea what had happened to her, she went to the University Health Service and the doctor just said, it seems you've had some kind of conversion experience. She writes in the book, I don't know what I've been converted from to, but because she had no way to understand it cognitively, she and no practice, by the way, no way to deepen it, and she just just was left flabbergasted by the whole thing, and then as the years went by, the joy of it gradually faded because she was not sustaining it with a practice, a meditation practice. And it took 25 years before she happened to meet Yasutani Roshi in Los Angeles. And in describing this to him, he said, well, it definitely sounded like what we call Kensho, or enlightenment. And then I think she said she went back to practice, and don't know how much of it she reclaimed, if any of it. Back to Ehrenreich's account. Of course, all such experiences can be seen as symptoms of one sort or another, and that is the way psychiatry has traditionally disposed of the mystically adept. The shaman was simply the local schizophrenic. Saint Teresa of Avila, a clear hysteric. The Delphic oracles may have been inhaling intoxicants. All of the great Christian mystics showed clear signs of temporal lobe epilepsy. A recent paper from Harvard Medical School proposes that the revelations experienced by Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and Paul can all be attributed to, quote, primary or mood disorder-associated psychotic disorders. I suspect we would have more reports of uncanny experiences from ordinary rational people if it were not for the fear of being judged insane or at least unstable. In another interview from Time magazine, the same month, this April of this month, she said, the interviewer asks, are you worried that people are going to think that you've gone crazy? And she says, I was educated as a scientist, and one of the things I learned was that you do not discard anomalous results. If you have a result that doesn't fit your theory, you could say, in her case, her paradigm, her way of understanding reality, that falls way off the curve in your graph, I'm sorry, you don't get to erase that. You have to figure out what's going on. So this is where Enlightenment East and Enlightenment, if we just for the sake of language, if we refer to what happened to her as a kind of opening, let's say Enlightenment. Enlightenment East and Enlightenment West, with its emphasis on science, come together in this remarkable woman. You don't get to erase that anomalous result, that experience she had. It didn't fit with her scientific mind. She couldn't interpret it scientifically. And she says, I'm just opening up the conversation. If in the process I completely ruin my reputation as a rational person and end up in a locked ward, that's the chance I'm taking. Later she says, the questioner asks, would you ever explore the idea that this other that you've experienced could be God? And she says, I would not explore monotheistic religions. The religions that impress me are those which involve ecstatic communion with a deity or spirit, like voodoo. I like that much better than belief. I have respect for that. But as I said, I'm not looking for anything, and I'm not going to church. Well, she says here, I like things with... I like practices involve ecstatic communion with a deity or spirit like voodoo. I like that much better than belief. This also, I wonder how, if she has any familiarity with Zen, because Zen is all about direct experience, not belief. You don't have to believe anything to do Zen meditation and come to awakening. In fact, the less you believe, the better. A belief is something that becomes an obstacle in the mind. It's something that you have to let go of. The only thing you have to believe in, really, is that sitting is going to work for you, that it has some value. Otherwise, you won't even sit. Then she continues in her opinion piece. An alternative to the insanity explanation would be that such experiences do represent some sort of encounter. It was my scientific training, oddly enough, that eventually nudged me to consider this possibility. Sometime in middle age, when I had become a writer and amateur historian, I decided that the insanity explanation may have been a cop-out, that I could have seen something. I could have seen something that morning in Lone Pine. The wonderful thing about science is that it's dedicated to finding out the way things are. Truth is another word, but it's so abstract. Science at its best is just looking into and investigating to see how things are in their true aspect. And that's where they come together, this enlightenment East and West, where we can use that. Let's drop enlightenment East and West for a minute and consider the mystical or contemplative perspective or approach to life, and in her case, social and political activism. They have the same. It's the same project they're working on. People of those two approaches. The project is liberation. Those in social and political activism are going about it. In one way, that's one mode of aspiring to liberation, and those who are doing it in the contemplative, mystical, it's meditative way are going about it in that mode. They came together last weekend in New York when our Earth Vigil sat overlooking this People's Climate March. I'm going to describe the experience in the upcoming Zenbo, but it was just remarkable. Here were all these people, each in her or his own way, demonstrating visibly, theatrically, loudly, demonstrating their engagement with the world, their aspiration to resolve a very, very grave issue that we're all facing. They were in motion. They were active. And then there were the, at times, I guess, 100 of us sitting in meditation on a slight knoll on the edge of Central Park, sitting and sitting with them in a way, in the deepest sense. At first, when this river of people came approaching us in the street, I had a slight concern that they might see us as setting ourselves apart. Not valuing what they were doing, but it seemed to be anything but that. I didn't look up much, but occasionally I would take a peek at what was going on down there, and others who apparently were looking up more reported that we were getting a lot of appreciative responses from these 311,000 people pouring past us like this wide river that went on for 4 hours. People turned, and either they gestured somehow with their hands palm to palm, or their hand on their heart to show solidarity with us, or we would hear shouts of "Thank you, Earth Vigil," "Thank you, meditators." And I was so grateful that they understood what we were doing there. We were with them. We were engaging in our own way. Not actively. Or yes, actively. Sitting still, but thoroughly, actively engaged with them and this whole matter of climate change, this whole problem. It was a wonderful fusion of the contemplative and the active, and a mutual nourishing going on there. We were getting so much from that. It was absolutely exhilarating. I'm going to say in this article that I write, it was the most moving, overwhelming public experience of my life. And hopefully they were getting able to receive the energy that we were offering, not just to them, but to the whole universe. Whenever we sit, even at home, if you're sitting at home, in Zen we sit with the eyes open, and this too, it's not just the contemplative or passive or so-called mystical side of things, where we're shutting out the world and withdrawing into our precious little space of calmness and peace. It's in Zen we keep the eyes open so that we maintain our connection, and for other reasons, to stay more alert and awake. But in doing that, it really, I think, speaks to our continued connection to the world. And in sitting with others, here too, this so-called inner, or the going in, as differentiated from the outward, going out, breaks down, because we're really supporting one another. It's kind of another version. Sitting with other people, coming here in the Zendo, is another version of what we were doing in New York, where we are all giving and receiving this wonderful exchange of energy that's happening. It's not just isolating ourselves. And this, in a much wider sense, is what we're seeing in the Dharma in the West. This is a huge, huge, this is a sea change in the Dharma, where that has been largely the practice of monks and nuns, the monastics in Asia, for 2,500 years. And now we see something entirely different, where virtually everyone practicing Zen and other forms of the Dharma have jobs and families, houses, apartments, kids, and find a way to either do retreats from time to time, or even aside from that, our mission is to bring this contemplative mind, this no mind, into everything we're doing, fusing the contemplative or the so-called mystical with the active. And the value of our concentration practices, our meditation, really depends on how engaged we are with our practice. That we're not just sitting and sifting through our thoughts and fantasies, but we're really, really working to get beyond our thoughts and fantasies. Then we're engaged, and it's active. And also, the motivation that we grow into. That is, if we can move beyond doing this for our own personal improvement or happiness, if we can move beyond that into doing this for the sake of all beings, purifying our minds in order to be able to give more cleanly and purely to others. That's why we do the four vows. This is what we're reminded of over and over again. All beings without number, I vow to liberate. And I have to say also that our activism, our social or political engagement itself, the value of that, I would argue, really depends on the degree to which we can do it selflessly. No-mindedly, where it's not for our self-interest, our own whatever ulterior, convoluted, neurotic reasons that we're acting out against authority or whatever, but that we're doing it in order to bring justice, true justice and peace and such things to the world. Back to her science could continue to dismiss mystical experiences as mental phenomena internal to ourselves, but the merest chance that they may represent some sort of contact or encounter justifies investigation. We need more data and more subjective accounts. This is wonderful, applying her scientific bent to this matter of mystical experiences. But we also need a neuroscience bold enough to go beyond the observation that we are wired for transcendent experience. The real challenge is to figure out what happens when those wires connect. Is science ready to take on the search for the source of our most uncanny experiences? Well, I would suggest that the source is mind. There's no other source. There can be no experiences of any kind apart from mind. Things are things because of mind. Mind is mind because of things. We chant this in affirming faith in mind. Fortunately, science itself has been changing. It was simply overwhelmed by the empirical evidence, starting with quantum mechanics and the realization that even the most austere vacuum is a happening place, bursting with possibility and giving birth to bits of something, even if they're only fleeting particles of matter and antimatter. Without invoking anything supernatural, we may be ready to acknowledge that we are not, after all, alone in the universe. There is no evidence for a god or gods, least of all caring ones, but our mystical experiences give us tantalizing glimpses of other forms of consciousness, which may be beings of some kind, ordinarily invisible to us and our instruments. Or it could be that the universe is itself pulsing with a kind of life and capable of bursting into something that looks to us momentarily like the flame. See, she still is wondering, searching whether there is some other. And this, I think, suggests that she hasn't seen through self another. How can there be any other? She says that we may, after all, not be alone in the universe. We are all one with the universe. In that sense, we are alone. There's only the Buddha has reportedly said, this is one of the legends of Buddhism, when he was a baby, he took seven steps and said, above the heavens and below the heavens, I alone, the world-honored one, I all one. I hope that she may finish the work she started there. You wonder why, you have to wonder whether it was just too unsettling to her, too confounding for her, that she had to compartmentalize it, she had to set it aside, park it somewhere, and move on with her research and education, and that now at the age of 73, she's finally able to face that and then return to this state of wonder that led to the experience so many years ago. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.